Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we are back bringing you a clinical installment of the Disaster Podcast episode tonight. We'll get into more about that in just a bit. But of course, we've got to bring in our co-host, Sam Bradley, who is dealing with melting snow and Skype issues tonight. So we've got her on her cell phone. And hey, Sam, what's up?
Yeah, there's solar flares or something going on because my computer has been a big pain in the patoot here lately. I don't know what's going on. But what we do know what's going on is the weather. And we have both our meteorologists on tonight, which is very cool because there's a lot of weather to talk about. So, Becky, you were just talking about the rain up in your area, in Jamie's area on the East Coast, eh?
Yeah, so that is rain from what is sort of the remnant leftover area of low pressure from Hurricane Zeta that made landfall yesterday morning in Louisiana. And believe it or not, that center of low pressure went from making landfall yesterday at about 6 p.m. Eastern time to is now off the East Coast. So in just over 24 hours, it was a very, very quick moving storm. Did produce some pretty intense winds where it made landfall in Louisiana, upwards of 100, 110 miles per hour, and then produced those gusty winds through much of the southeast, so Alabama, Georgia, the Carolinas, Virginia, a lot of trees down, a lot of power outages. It's actually a really cool map. I should link to this from Power Outage website that you can see exactly the track where Zeta moved and produced those strong winds, and then has now been just dumping rain across the mid-Atlantic and into southern New England today. So Jamie and myself are definitely getting a lot of rain. It's very needed rain for a lot of us. There's some drought conditions here in the Northeast, so mostly beneficial rain, but it's definitely caused some flooding issues, and the winds have also caused some issues in some areas with bringing down trees and causing power outages, even up into the East Coast.
Well, Becky, now that we're at Zeta, is that the end of the Greek alphabet?
It's not, actually. We have another, 15 letters we could go through if we need it.
How did we get to Z so fast? I'm not quite sure how that works.
But. Yeah, it's in the middle of the alphabet.
Well, and I believe the 5-day forecast outlook for the Atlantic tropical area is showing a potential storm that might pop up 5 or 6 days from now in the Caribbean. So
yes,
so that's Ada, right?
I think so. I haven't actually looked at the next letter. Kyle says yes.
We're just worried about the ones that are here at the moment.
Yeah, at that point, that disturbance is progged to head somewhere in the Central America vicinity, but certainly something to keep an eye out for. Again, as we've been saying, tropical season is not over yet.
It doesn't seem like it ever will be. Mr. Kyle, good to have you back. You and I got a ton of snow, didn't we?
Oh, absolutely. We did, Sam. And hello, everyone on the Disaster Podcast land. Meteorologist Kyle Nelson, a.k.a. The Weather Squatch, back with you again after a brief reprieve. However, we talk about a lot of tropical things, but believe it or not, kind of looking back at the last week or so of weather, it's really been a week of interconnected weather impacts across the U.S. As Sam hinted at, we had record cold, snow, ice, and all kinds of, shall we say, fun impacts from the Northern Rockies into the Great Plains, with temperatures up to 60 degrees colder than average, and a low as minus 33 degrees in Ebron, Colorado. That temporarily brought the Colorado wildfires down out of the crown of the trees onto the forest floor with those below zero temperatures and more than a foot of snow, allowing those incredibly heroic wildland firefighters to start to get a handle on things and start getting some of those containment lines fortified and in place. Following that, the Oklahoma ice storm, which impacted much of western and central Oklahoma, some areas receiving over 2 inches of ice accumulation, and that's measured in diameter. So if it's, say, accumulated around a tree branch or a twig or something, you measure it from edge to edge, 2 inches. So just try to imagine that on trees that were nearly fully leafed out, that left hundreds of thousands without power. So widespread, devastating impacts, even though much of Oklahoma has moved some of their utilities underground, those impacts were still quite widespread. And that Arctic air mass actually that brought that record cold to Colorado and that ice storm to Oklahoma actually helped to intensify Hurricane Zeta in its in about the 24 to 36 hours before it made landfall. So it was actually more intense than forecasted. And then as Becky hinted at and explained so well, it moved right up from Louisiana up through the Alabama, Mississippi, the Carolinas into the Northeast, producing widespread impacts because when that storm came ashore, all that wind and the water contained within it just kept moving forward and produced those widespread impacts. So now I believe over 2.5 million tonight as we record without power. So yes, hello. From Zeta, the ice storm, wildfires, and more, it was all interconnected this week.
That's crazy. Well, you talk about crazy things. We were looking out the front window the other day, and there was some guy on skis who was hooked to a car that was blazing down the street. And I thought, well, Coloradans will take advantage of whatever's come their way. So, but, you know, the fires is an interesting thing because I get all the alerts on the Cameron Peak fire because of the fact it's so close. And they're starting now to downgrade the evacuation. So that's a good sign. It did, however, create some access problems for the firefighters getting up there in the snow. And I think one engine ended up going over the side, but I never heard the outcome on that. But, you know, it created not as many problems as it did help, but we can hope it continues to help. What anything coming up this week, Kyle, that you're aware of, besides what Becky told us?
Well, not so much besides what Becky told us, but just to add on to that, if Ada does become a named storm, it would tie the 2005 season record for the most named storms recorded in an Atlantic hurricane season.
Well, it's 2020, so that's no big surprise. I'm sure there are numbers of other records that will be broken in the next 2 months of this year, which I will be glad that it's over with. Wow. So Dr. Joe's with us, and as it happens, he's our special guest tonight because he's got things to tell us about new CPR standards. And Joe, you mentioned you sent us something from takeheartamerica.org. You want to tell us about them?
Yeah, hi guys. I lost you there for just a minute. So hello everyone. And what Sam's referring to is that Take Heart America, which is a international collegial group of researchers and educators around cardiac arrest, was named an award recipient from the American Heart Association for all the work that's been done around advancing research and education in cardiac arrest and doing so with an international approach. So quite proud to be part of that group and glad to see some recognition for some really smart and amazing people that I'm proud to work with.
That's excellent. And we know you at Paragon have done a lot of CPR-based research with your cadavers and other things. We haven't heard too much about that lately. What have you been doing?
Well, it's been busy. I think a couple of things that we've been doing is we've had several innovative developments, I guess, over the last few months. So one of the things that we did was in conjunction with the virtual EMS World this year, Take Heart America had our third annual meeting as part of a pre-conference to EMS World. And as part of that meeting, we actually were pleased to do a virtual cadaver lab demonstrating the physiologic capabilities of that model and able to show people in real time virtually from all over the world some of the insights into the physiology of CPR. So that was a very cool experience. I believe that that entire, I guess, I think that was all done on Zoom, if I remember right, but, you know, webinar, however they did it, should be available soon for folks to go back and be able to watch that. So I hope folks will get a chance to see that. I think that'll be done through EMS World soon. And then we have taken a lot of the stuff that we have learned in the lab, and we can talk more about that later, and pushed it into the field and are doing some field trials and that sort of stuff with everything from heads-up CPR to sort of a little bit different approach, which is actually part of what Take Heart has been working on aggressively, and that's kind of how we are putting together all the different pieces that are necessary to really significantly improve outcomes in cardiac arrest.
Well, Joe, can you, for those of us that aren't as up to date on CPR as we maybe used to be, tell us some of those things like you were talking about just now that are new concepts and what makes them clinically relevant.
Well, I'd be glad to, Sam. So, you know, I think a lot of what we have come to appreciate is that even under the best of circumstances, good old standard manual CPR is really not very effective. At best, we might get 20% perfusion. And quite honestly, that's really probably not enough for maintaining the brain in a state that is intact after a resuscitation, and is probably the reason that current cardiac arrest outcomes are so poor. And I think it's really not because people aren't trying and aren't doing a good job. It's just that that technique in and of itself, without help, is just not really adequate to get the job done. So one of the things that we now come to realize is that because manual standard CPR is really just not terribly effective, that really what's necessary is adjuncts to CPR to really help improve cardiac output and flow through the brain, which obviously is the key point here. So items like the ITD, the rescue pod, really enhance the vacuum in the chest during recoil and improve filling of the heart as well as emptying of the head, making room for more arterial blood flow into the head. But sort of pushing on even beyond that, you know, we've seen mechanical CPR devices really come into their own. I think that part of what we've learned about mechanical CPR devices is that while they're not necessarily better at CPR than people are, they are more consistent than people are. And that difference is better. That's what makes the difference. So people can do perfect CPR. They just can't do it very long, and they certainly can't do it very well if you're trying to move a patient in the back of an ambulance or down the stairs or anywhere else. So there's lots of advantages to mechanical CPR. And then I'm sorry, Sam.
I said amen to that, but since I interrupted you anyway, are there that many areas or departments or agencies around the country that aren't using one of those CPR devices?
Well, I think it's a mixed bag. You know, there's a lot of different technologies out there, including active compression, decompression, CPR, which has been on the market for a few years now and is very effective at producing blood flow. And what we've been looking at most recently is heads up CPR, which requires many of these other things we've been talking about in order to generate enough flow to be able to pump blood uphill. but that elevation of the head and the chest a bit during CPR have actually proven to be extremely beneficial as far as cerebral perfusion pressure flows in the head and reducing the chance of anoxic brain injury. So I think part of what we're seeing is that there's no one single silver bullet here. It really is a combination of things that are important in cardiac arrest. And most importantly, we actually were just talking about this on a conference call today. A lot of what we have come to realize is that most of the things that really seem to make a huge difference, and I mean not only sort of in some early clinical trials, but in the laboratory, in animal models, in the cadaver model, it is consistent throughout all of our studies, is that the majority of these things, like high quality CPR, impedance threshold device, active compression, decompression CPR, which supraglottic airway you use, reducing pauses, heads up CPR, all of these things together are all actually BLS level interventions. And yet with those BLS level interventions, if they are all done together, you can produce cerebral perfusion pressures that are honestly quite close to normal. And so I think part of what we have really come to appreciate is that a lot of these ALS interventions that we've talked about or looked at in the past, as far as drug interventions, some of that kind of stuff, really have never proven themselves to make a huge amount of difference. But we're seeing very clearly that a set of BLS interventions, particularly a symbiotic set of BLS interventions, that is a bundle of care, are really making a difference in how good the perfusion is during cardiac arrest, how likely you are to get a neurologically intact survivor afterwards.
Wow. Jamie, you had a question.
Well, I just, it's interesting, having watched this evolution over the last, 10, 15 years, which is what, 3 or 4 updates, it's been interesting to see that evolution away from ALS intervention necessity and into this idea that comprehensive BLS systemic care. Because we still have to start with early CPR, moving into what we're seeing with adjuncts and mechanical CPR, as you talked about, Joe. It's just interesting to see how that has all come together over the last few years, and it's been really supported by the research, right? I mean, that's what's been driving all of this, is just consistently doing more and more research to see the fundamentals and how it works.
Yeah, you're exactly right, Jamie. I think what's been fascinating about the research is really about better understanding the physiology that's happening, not only sort of in cardiac arrest, but in our interventions to reverse cardiac arrest. And the idea that we can see a difference in blood flow and aortic pressures that are generated based on where the compressor's hands are located on the victim's chest. And that's really related to you'd like to say it's on the lower half of the sternum for everybody, but for some patients, based on their own anatomy and that kind of stuff, moving a little further down and a little more to the left actually results in better output. And that's simply related to variances in the anatomy and sort of where the heart sits behind the
the sternum and where the sternum is on that patient and all that sort of stuff. And so there, you know, there are many, many, many tiny details like that that are all extremely important in cardiac arrest and are a challenge, of course, to manage because there are so many of them. And I think part of what we've also seen is that it is because there are so many details, folks lose an appreciation for how profoundly important those small details are, how much of a difference they make in outcomes. And therefore, those details are not addressed the way they need to be addressed. And so part of our approach is really looking at putting together this sort of bundled approach, meaning a whole series of enhancements, tools, adjuncts, et cetera, that hopefully address many of these small details and allow us to maximize the performance of CPR so that we can maximize brain perfusion and again, maximize successful resuscitations.
Absolutely. Well, Kyle's burning up and running around in circles, so I think he has a question and a comment.
Well, just a question, Joe. With the research that Paragon has done and additionally things that you've seen come across your screen from Eagles and such things like that, have you seen any marked changes to either American Heart or American Red Cross CPR guidelines or recommendations for professional responders this year or going into next year?
I haven't yet. I know that many of those updates are underway. And part of the approach of Take Heart has been sort of at our first inception, it was really to, based on this concept of what if we took all of these recommendations that American Heart has put out and tried to implement all of those at the same time. And that sort of led us from this idea that there's a lot of good recommendations in there, but that our implementation of them is spotty and inconsistent, and really, again, pushing that. And so I think as American Heart now begins to see the outcomes of many of the studies that we're doing, they're having a greater appreciation for the value of this sort of bundled approach, and that perhaps we do indeed need to change the way that we teach that both to lay rescuers as well as professional rescuers.
Wow. I keep thinking back to the 80s when I started and they had just quit using intracardiac needles and it was all about the drugs. And that's kind of mind blowing that it's come back to basics like this. Becky, any thoughts on your part?
No, I'm just absorbing all of this. This is all pretty new information for me. So this is one of those episodes where I learn a lot.
So Joe, is the team concept still a thing? It was kind of divided into BLS and ALS, but now it seems like it's really focused on the BLS effort and whoever's there will do that.
Well, I don't think it's intentionally meant to sort of split the two. Obviously, the ALS skill set is still vitally important for many different aspects of that. But what has become more apparent is that there is so much more that is really in the BLS wheelhouse that has huge impacts on survivability and cardiac arrest. I think, you know, for me, it's really an appreciation that is much more impactful than we thought it was before. To your comment a few minutes ago about it was all about the drugs, as we look at the stuff that we do in the lab, particularly in the animal model stuff, it is blatantly clear to me that drugs are a very poor substitute for good perfusion. We've had many, many animal models that we've done high quality CPR on for 30 minutes and have been able to successfully resuscitate those animals with a half dose of epinephrine and a single shock. And the vast majority of those animals convert to a perfusible rhythm immediately, get ROSC immediately, and are neurologically intact at 24 hours. And, you know, perfusion is a drug, and it is the best drug. And while those other drugs are valuable in certain situations, there's nothing like good perfusion. That's still got to be the core underlying it all.
Well, I'll make training in ACLS a lot better.
And Kyle, I think you had a follow-up question, didn't you?
Oh, thanks, Jamie. So, Joe, following up on, because you touched on the you know, American Heart recommendations, things like that, but I like to kind of switch perspectives a little bit because you emphasize the role of the BLS provider, right? Basic life support, so the you know, the trained responder, but I'd like to walk it back now to the untrained bystander who calls 911 because they've witnessed someone have a sudden cardiac event. And I'd like to know, Joe, if you have any thoughts on gaining compliance for 911 callers to convert them from bystanders to responders to perform CPR in the COVID-19 environment with concerns that they may have for that individual possibly having some sort of COVID-19-like symptoms?
Well, that's a great question, very complex one. It is very clear from studies from around the world that things like telephone, instruction on how to perform CPR and lay or bystander responders on CPR make a huge difference in outcomes. There's just no question that is important, and we absolutely have to continue doing that. I think the COVID environment has made that much more complicated. I think for, you know, a family member who's, right there in the home, the concern is probably a bit less. They obviously know the patient's history and know if they've been ill recently and, whether or not there's likely anything to be concerned about from an exposure standpoint. But obviously in a public setting where the bystander may have no knowledge of the cardiac arrest victim, it really makes for a very difficult situation. I think hands-on CPR is an effort to address that to some extent. And there is some solid science there that says, just compressions alone can be enough. But I certainly can appreciate that even the act of doing compressions on somebody is going to generate potentially some air being expelled from the lungs, maybe laced with COVID, and that might potentially be an exposure. So the pandemic has certainly made cardiac arrest care very challenging in the last 6 months or so.
Oh my God, yes. One last question for you, Joe. We talked about a little bit about where we've been and certainly where we are. What is your vision of the future? If you had the ability to see where we were with this in 5 or 10 years, other than what you've already talked about, is there anything else that you can see that might change?
Well, it's interesting you say that, Sam. So one of the things that we are looking to do and actually have come out of our early evaluation related to heads up CPR is that there appears to be a very clear relationship between early implementation of high quality CPR and the heads up CPR sequence. And by that, I mean there's a certain amount of time, a certain height, and a certain, speed that you get to that height and all that sort of stuff that are optimum. And so there's a device that's designed to address all those details, as we were mentioning earlier. And so what we've noticed is that the sooner that intervention is started, the much more likely you are to have a higher ROSC rate and a higher neurologically intact survival rate, which obviously makes sense. But the point behind that is that we're now looking to see if we can't perhaps package the AED, the mechanical CPR device, the heads up device, along with a simple supraglottic airway, the ITD, a viral filter for today's times, a few other very simple tools like that into a single bag, honestly. In other words, it's all sort of packaged right there with the mechanical CPR device and the heads up device, so that a BLS crew responding to a scene has everything from a BLS standpoint all in the same bag. And they simply lay the thing out on the floor, start compressions, open things up, get it ready to go, slide the elevation device under the patient, connect the mechanical CPR device, put a supraglottic airway in, add the ITD, and within 1 minute they're at extremely high quality CPR on those patients. And that sort of package of getting all that done quickly and having it all put together in such a way that it is extremely convenient. I don't have to search through three different bags to find my stuff. We don't need an IV. We don't need drugs. We just need this stuff right now. I think the future is going to be making certain that we are thinking through the processes properly so that we can implement the tools that we know that work in such a way that we maximize their effect, and in such a way that we reduce the number of small details that often get missed because people do not understand the physiology with enough depth to appreciate how important that small detail is.
Wow, that is our perfect world. That and maybe teaching a lot of lay responders how to do CPR. Kyle, do you have the last question? Throw it out.
Sure, Joe. I like to take things to the non-urban environment, given the second glorious snowfall in Colorado this season. It really got me thinking with your heads up versus heads down CPR conversation on when we're transporting a patient down the hill in a rescue toboggan or a rescue sled, their positioning, right? Because typically the thought had been, well, we want to keep that blood flow to the brain, so we're going to transport them head down if we're doing CPR on a medical cardiac arrest patient. But it sounds like what you're saying is that best practice is in order to allow for that venous drainage from the brain and the head is head up, sounds like the new recommendation.
Well, that's a great question, Kyle. I think the challenge there is that heads up CPR makes sense if, and it's a big if, you are able to provide adequate high quality CPR to overcome the height, right? You got to pump blood uphill. And if you can't do consistent high quality CPR, you're actually making their perfusion worse. So I can only imagine the challenges of trying to get a patient down a mountainside in a basket while you're doing CPR, et cetera. And I think under those circumstances, if there's a way to do it, neutral is probably better than heads down. But I would be very reluctant to say that heads up makes more sense, because I would think that in that environment, under those circumstances, the ability to consistently provide that high quality CPR would be virtually impossible, and therefore much likely to result in poorer brain perfusion.
Yeah, unfortunately, mountains go down. But that was a great question, Kyle, because you're looking at the logistics of ski patrol, and that really was a good question and a great answer. Jamie, I'm going to throw it back to you.
Well, I really look forward to these clinical episodes with Joe, and appreciate all the wonderful research that you're connected with on this topic, Joe, because it really, I think, brings a unique bit of information to the podcast audience on a regular basis. So thank you for doing that. I'll just kind of segue here that, you know, that's one of the reasons we're so happy to be connected with you and Paragon Medical Education Group, because you are so tied into the research and at all levels, whether it's cardiac care, whether it's disaster relief and disaster management and education. Where can folks find you if they want to connect and be part of being on the cutting edge like that?
Well, thanks, Jamie. So before I answer that question, I had an additional thought for Kyle, and that is that due to those extremely challenging circumstances, to me, it may make more sense to stay where you are on the hill and work that arrest until you get ROSC and then move them. I'll just leave it with that, Kyle. You figure out how to do that. In the meantime, you can find us in the lab and places like that. To connect with us, find us on the web at Paragon Medical Education Group or our Facebook page by the same name. Or you can always reach us through the Disaster Podcast Facebook page or on the disasterpodcast.com website.
And I urge people to check that out because there are just unique, customizable opportunities there for anyone out there looking for unique training scenarios and unique training opportunities for your crews. So take advantage of what they have to offer. Becky, where can folks find you if they want to keep up with what's going on in the weather universe?
On Twitter at WX_Bex and the Disaster Podcast Facebook page.
And Kyle, where can folks find you?
Well, Jamie, I'd love to connect with our listeners to continue the conversation. They can find me on LinkedIn, Twitter, and all the social media spaces under the handle WX Kyle Nelson, as well as in the Disaster Podcast Facebook group.
And Sam, how about you?
Well, all of the above places under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11. And I love our Facebook group, which is pushing toward 1,000. That's just mind blowing that we have that many people that are engaged in our discussions. What about you, Jamie?
Well, you can find me under the handle PodMedic in most social media locations out there. So please look me up, and it's good to connect on however you all are available. Of course, the best way to really follow what we're doing and what's going on is either at disasterpodcast.com, where you can click the links at the top of every episode page to subscribe to the show, or you can go over to our Facebook group and just search Disaster Podcast on Facebook and find our group there. Request to join. We'd love to have you in there. We have most of our guests come in and join the group, so you can ask questions about episodes you've heard and connect with people there. So I urge you to do that. We've had several great articles that have been posted by some of the membership in the group recently. And so I urge you to head over and check it out if you haven't been by visiting recently, including a great article I found from the CDC about some disease detectives that are talking about how they use sewage viral levels in sewage treatment plants to predict outbreaks, usually a week ahead of time before they start showing up in testing centers. And I think, Joe, you talked about that probably a couple months ago when we were talking about COVID updates one of our weeks.
Yeah, I think you're right. I remember us having that conversation.
So anyway, you know, that's what the group's there for. It's there for the community to continue the discussion beyond our weekly podcasts. And we hope you'll continue to do that. Sam, great episode tonight. And it's always good to have these discussions and kind of keep up to date on the clinical side of things.
You bet. And obviously, hey, this is near and dear to Joe's heart. So we'll be hearing more about this as things progress. And, geez, what can we say about this? today's CPR is definitely not our everyday CPR.